Hi, everybody. It's Dr. Eric Quorum, founder of AIM7. Welcome back to The Blueprint, where we distill cutting-edge science, leadership, and life skills into simple tactics optimized for your busy lifestyle and goals. You better buckle up because today's podcast is going to be a little controversial. It's going to address our healthcare system and how it impacts your health and wellness. And here's the question you need to ask yourself. Is our healthcare system designed to keep us dependent on medications and procedures, or is it designed to get us healthy and thriving? Today, we have Dr. Leland Stillman, a board-certified physician with over 13 years of clinical experience on the show to discuss this important question. Dr. Stillman is a rare blend. He's a physician with a global view of health and wellness. He's highly educated on everything from circadian biology to physical training, nutrition, and supplementation. And he's actually partnered with a previous guest of ours, Jim Laird, to bring a unique blend of medical and lifestyle performance concierge services to their clients. Not only are we going to discuss the medical system, but Dr. Stillman delivers a masterclass on light and its impact on our immunity, health and wellness, neurotransmitters, hormones, energy level, and so much more. But before we get started, I want you to take a moment and click the link in the show notes to sign up for my newsletter adaptation. Every Friday, I send you actionable tips on how you can become an adaptation machine. So stress doesn't debilitate you, but it becomes a force of growth in your life. Check it out now. The link is in the show notes. All right, let's get to our conversation with Dr. Stillman. So let's lean in and learn from the best. Dr. Stillman, before we get into the discussion today, can you just walk me through why you became a physician and about your medical training?
Absolutely. So I became a physician, I'm going to give you the short version, because when I was a kid, we had a lot of medical problems, my sister and I. My mother took us to the regular doctors. She has this really funny story where my sister's just come out of the operating room with the ENT, and the ENT has said, the operation was successful. We were able to relieve the fluid buildup in her sinuses, and my sister's throwing up in the emesis basin on my mother's lap. And my mother says, this is great. I'm so glad this is solved, right? This problem is solved. You know, we don't have to come back and do this again. And the doctor says, oh no, the holes will probably fill up again and heal, and we'll have to go in and do the surgery over. And my mother thinks to herself, there's got to be a better way. And then she took us to like everyone in town who the regular doctors would say, don't go see, the homeopath, the naturopath, the chiropractor. We saw some really kooky, really out there, really weird people. And it fascinated me and forced me to think, because here are all these smart, capable people, more or less, right, who are saying, I've got a paradigm, it works, and it's the best thing out there. And I just said, well, I really want to understand what actually works and who's actually right. And that led me down a very long road of mentorships and apprenticeships. And obviously, I went to conventional medical school to get my MD. And that was essentially because the naturopath who I first was mentored by said, it's the highest level of licensure. It will give you the most credibility. Plus, you'll be able to do things that nobody else can do without being thrown in jail, like surgeries, procedures, injections, and ordering the most advanced lab testing. So it'll give you the most latitude in what you choose to do, even if you go off and do something completely different later. So that was how I got into it.
Makes sense. So why do you think the modern health system is plotting to keep us sick?
Great question. It all comes down to the politics of medicine, where a very small group of corporate entities really have created an extremely profitable system that's set up to turn people into patients who are really just perpetual customers. It's very much a system that's organized around rent seeking, right? So if, I mean, and people are doing this, I see this stuff all over the news. I see it in my Instagram feed. People realize, right, if you own 1,000 houses and you rent those 1,000 houses out for $3,000 a month, you're making $3,000 a month times 1,000 houses times 12 months a year. You are a, I don't know if it's multimillionaire or multibillionaire, but you have a lot of money coming in. And that's very attractive to people, right? Well, imagine you have millions and tens of millions of people whose basic physiological function, their ability to get to work, their ability to think, their ability to function, their ability to perform in society is dependent upon your product, and they have to take it every single day. Now imagine your margin on making that product is greater than 50%. Imagine your product is, you've got a margin of 95% and someone's spending $500 a month, or their insurance is spending $500 a month. That's why we spend $1 in $4 on our health care, but people are sicker every year and getting worse and worse outcomes. It's not that drugs are bad. It's not that surgeries are not effective. It's not that doctors and hospitals are not full of smart people who want to do the right thing. It's the system at the top level has been totally co-opted and is controlled. And then they've created these massive moats, as they would call it in business, where you know, you can't just start a hospital. You can't just start a medical practice. You can't just do these things because you need licenses and you need permits and you need, I have a DEA license. I have a state medical license. I have certifications. We have all these different things that then make it harder and harder and that barrier to entry is higher. And they're just making more and more money the more complicated they make it, right? And so that's why the politicians are not in it to make people healthy. They're in it to create a system where their donors make the most money so that they can get reelected. And I don't think that's even a partisan thing anymore. I'm pretty sure everyone with any sense of what's going on in the world knows that that's the game.
So what's the solution? Like if they're trying to keep us sick, how do we stay well?
I really believe that entrepreneurs are the ones who deliver solutions to society, often in spite of the government. So people like me have seen this problem for what it is. And it's a very simple calculus, right? If somebody comes to me and they say, look, I'm 50, I'm 45, all of a sudden I'm feeling older than I should. I don't function well or as well as I did. I need that edge back. I need to know what's going on and why I'm not well. And then I've been spending my whole career building wealth, success, a network, a family, things I care about, all with the expectation that my last 30 to 40 to 50 years of life, I'm going to be functioning, not at the top of my game necessarily, but at a high level, right? It's interesting. If you ask people if they're more afraid of dementia or death, more people will report that they're more afraid of dementia than they are of death. And what that really means is you're afraid, more afraid of your decline in your functions and your abilities than you are afraid of the end of your life. And that's about meaning. It's about fulfillment. It's about the legacy we leave behind. And that's where I actually spend a lot of time talking with patients. You know, what does this mean to you? What is important to you? And then people see that and they realize, okay, if I've been running my car into the ground with a combination of diet and lifestyle choices, I need a different product than the healthcare system is providing me, which is essentially a system where I rent my own ability to function from them at a high, relative high price over a long period of time with no end to that expenditure, right? I need to have somebody on my team who's going to help me become the best version of myself and learn how to be healthy in a way that's sustainable. So people then are willing to take that, take their money and their time and invest it in programs with doctors like me, where we figure out what's really going on. We get them the progress they need in order to be healthy. We identify the big problems and big mistakes they're making in their diet, their lifestyle, everything from sleep timing to pre-sleep routine to when they wake up, what they do with their morning routine, how they eat, how they prepare their food, all of it, right? To then help them optimize their performance and their health.
So what are the biggest mistakes that you see that patients are making in their health and wellness?
Yes. The biggest mistakes that people are making is they're leaving so much low-hanging fruit on the tree. And that low-hanging fruit looks like, for example, and this goes back to really what do we know makes people live a long time in a good state of health? And, you know, when you go and you look at people who've lived a long time, and I used to ask these patients I would meet in the hospital in their 80s, 90s, who were, as we say, well-preserved. I would ask them, what's your secret? And they would say the funniest things to me. Like, I mean, I'll never forget this guy. He said, well, my doctor told me that every day at the end of the day, I had to go home and have two gin and tonics. This was a happy, jovial guy, and not a coincidence, by the way. So they worry a lot less about little things like smoking a couple cigarettes here and there or having a glass of brandy or, you know, I see funny headlines like 104-year-old lady says secret to her success is three Dr. Peppers a day, right? They worry less about that stuff, but you talk to them and they do things like they garden, they walk, they had an active life, they had a social life, they had positive social connection. That's a really big predictor of longevity. We actually know very, very well that the more sun you get, the lower your risk of death, which is funny. I talk about that a lot. People who follow me are very aware of that, but most people hear from dermatologists, the sun is dangerous. It's going to give you skin cancer and it's going to make you look like a wrinkled paper bag. Well, skin cancer is more likely the more sun you get, the paler your skin is. But even those people have a lower risk of death when they get more sun. So I sometimes joke with my patients, if they want to live long enough to look like a wrinkled paper bag and need a dermatologist, they should get at least some sun exposure.
What's the benefits of the sun? Like my background is in sleep. We talk a lot about, you know, the circadian drive and Zeitgebers and things like that. But besides anchoring our circadian clock, and we can talk about that a little bit, but what are some other things that people are missing out on?
Okay, I'm going to break this down into the benefits of sunlight as a whole spectrum of light, visible to ultraviolet. And then I'm going to talk about the behavioral effects of getting more light, because it's really profound. So number one, sunlight, 42% of it approximately is infrared, which means that it's warmth. You perceive it as warmth. You don't see it with your eye. You can see it in night vision goggles. You could see it on an infrared camera, which is essentially what night vision goggles are. That infrared light actually basically builds your cellular battery. This is the work of Gerald Pollack, PhD. He runs the journal Water. Gilbert Lang before him, and then people like Mei-Hwan Ho and a variety of other researchers in the quantum biology field. So infrared light builds your cellular battery. It literally increases your ability to make energy. That's why you'll see things like, for example, Thor Photobiomodulation will advertise the fact that Olympians are using their red and infrared light therapy beds to improve their performance and their recovery. That's part of how they're doing that. So then there's infrared light, then there's the visible spectrum, and you go through red, orange, yellow, green, and then blue. The red spectrum also tunes and increases your cellular battery, and that's photobiomodulation. The yellows and the oranges, there's not that much physiologically that I'm aware of them doing, but then you get into the blues and the greens, and those are your Zeitgebers, your timing for circadian rhythms, right? So they tell your brain to wake up and go, and their absence then allows you to go to sleep. So people don't realize this, but glass blocks a lot of infrared light. And so by being indoors, we're already losing out on the benefits of infrared light. You want to know more about the benefits of infrared light? I mean, sauna is basically putting yourself in a giant infrared light box. That's largely what sauna is. So we see all these huge benefits to sauna. Largely, these are benefits of infrared light. Now, the heat component's a different thing, so I won't get into that. But it's important to understand that benefit's there.
There's like infrared sauna versus like a dry hot sauna. Are you saying a dry hot sauna, the benefit is light?
Oh, great question. This actually depends on the form of energy and how the sauna is transmitting its energy, right? So, oh man, don't quote me on this because this is basic physics 101. It's been a minute. But there's three ways to transfer energy as light. There's convection, conduction, and radiation. So if you jump into a Finnish traditional sauna, well, the rocks that you pour the water on and the water becomes steam and the steam precipitates on your skin. So those rocks are emitting infrared light, right? Mm-hmm. But the heat transfer is mostly happening through the water, which then increases the humidity, and then the humidity increases the transference of the heat from the rocks to your skin. How much of that ends up coming in as infrared light is, I'm not sure, right? Versus the conduction from the water to the body. If you're in an infrared sauna, right, which has got huge panels of infrared and they're, you know, light emitting diodes in the panels, right? That's light. So infrared sauna is all that. If you're using something like the sauna space, which is my sauna, I use it. I love it. It's a big bulb, and that bulb emits a combination of infrared light and red light. And so you're getting radiative heat.
I love sauna space. I had their CEO on.
Yeah.
My sister's one of their biggest endorsers for a very long time. I go to her house and she's got a infrared sauna inside of a Faraday tent. And I love it. I just go abuse that thing every time I show up in town. I need to get one for my desk. I need to get the bulb right there. But the research on it is, if you go to SaunaSpace's website, you go down and look at the literature, you're like, we're not talking kooky stuff. Like, you can really get into it and be like, this is very interesting. What is his name? I'm blanking right now.
Ryan Richards.
Yes. Very smart. Mm-hmm. He does his homework. And they like, it's all handcrafted out at their facility. It's pretty cool. Anyways.
That's right. It's a really cool product, yeah. So yeah, sauna, very important. Red and infrared light, sunlight. And then the blue and greens, right? Critical for circadian rhythms. And then the UV light is amazing. UVA has all these effects on the endocrine system. Things like alpha-melanocyte stimulating hormone or alpha-MSH is thought of as just being the thing that makes people tan. But the truth is, alpha-MSH has all these effects on your immune system and your brain. It's really like a neurohormone. So not a lot of people talk about the therapeutic benefits of that. There's some people using MSH as a therapeutic. I'm not using it right now myself in my practice because I don't need it. I got a lot of other stuff to put people through and on in the practice. But yeah, alpha MSH is amazing. And so you're getting that to secrete from your brain with exposure to UVA light. And it is a real benefit. If you look at the data on, say, autoimmune disease, I mean, autoimmune disease increases as you go further and further and further away from the equator. It's not just vitamin D, which is one of the big misses people make. They think, okay, I don't get any sunlight, I'd better take my vitamin D. That's true. But if the effect of sunlight on reducing your risk of death was all related to vitamin D, then normalizing your vitamin D level should confer the same mortality decrease as getting sunlight, and it doesn't. So getting sunlight is superior to taking a vitamin D supplement, which is part of why I actually don't use a vitamin D supplement. I use either the sun or a vitamin D lamp, which is a UVB lamp. And it's interesting. People always ask me about the skin cancer thing, right? So it's interesting. We've used UVB therapeutically for about 100 years now. The Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology was awarded to, I think it was a Scandinavian, might have been a Brit or a Scot, in the early 1900s, and it was Niels Finsen, now that I'm remembering it. He was awarded the Nobel Prize for the use of UVB light in the treatment of cutaneous tuberculosis. And we've been using UVB light for 100 years. There's no increase in skin cancer with therapeutic use of UVB light, which is very interesting. It means that all the skin cancer is coming from the UVA, not the UVB. UVB triggers vitamin D production in the skin, right? So I use the vitamin D lamp for 5 minutes and it gives me all the UVB I need to make all the vitamin D that I need. No one's ever studied this that I know of, but I'm convinced that UVB light is going to provide a mortality benefit that's greater and above just taking vitamin D as a supplement. I look forward to one day somebody actually studying that, but I'm not holding my breath. It will be a big undertaking.
Where do you buy UVB lamps?
It's a company called Spurti. S-P-E-R-T-I. They make a tanning lamp and they make some SAD lamps and they make a UVB lamp. The thing about SAD lamps that makes me sad is that everyone producing them totally misses out on the reality of the importance of red and infrared light. It's actually something that I'm more and more concerned about because what people need to realize is that sunlight is perfectly balanced for your physiology. The red and the infrared portions of sunlight heal and fortify your skin in a very literal sense of the words. And the blue and the green actually create things called lipid peroxides, which are they can trigger cancer formation, right? One of my questions is, let's say we've spent 98% of our time indoors under lights, CFLs, fluorescents, LEDs that have no red and infrared light. We're getting tons of blue and green. We don't perceive the difference in our eye. It looks the same to us. But what if the blue and green is causing stress and lipid peroxidation in the skin that's then triggering the formation of skin cancers? And that would explain why skin cancer rates are going up, despite the fact that sun exposure is going down. And so I'll sometimes say to people that if the sun causes skin cancer, then spoons make people fat. It's not a fair comparison. And the real proof of this pudding is actually in the only study of sun exposure in melanoma survivors. So this woman named Marianne Berwick and her colleagues did this study where they looked at patients who had survived. And this is a little bit fuzzy in my brain. It's been a year or two since I looked at this study, but they looked at people who'd survived a melanoma or had melanoma. I can't remember which it was. And they said, if melanoma is really related to sun exposure, then the people who get less sun and use sunscreen should have a longer survival than the people who don't. And it turns out that the people who get the most sun with or after a diagnosis of melanoma live the longest, right? Which is counterintuitive if the sun is the cause of melanoma. And it's because of the effects of sunlight on vitamin D production, the health of the overall organism, its resiliency, its immunity. And that's why the data is very clear. The more sun you get, the lower your risk of death.
Super interesting. This is some stuff I have not heard before. When my doctoral work was in sleep and stress resilience, and so you learn about homeostatic drive and circadian drive and all this kind of stuff. And then we kind of looked further. A lot of my research was on how sleep impacts our ability to adapt to stress. So we looked at things, slow cortical potentials in the brain. That's a discussion for another time. But I'd really love to offline with you sometime about some of the literature so I can upskill myself in this area. I crave being outside. And one of the
Would you like to know why?
Why?
Okay. So number one, it's not linear. Have you ever read? No, you must not have. So read. I'll give you some resources, and I'll just rattle them off now, and I'll send them to you in written form later. But read The Influence of Ocular Light Perception on Metabolism in Animal and in Man by Fritz Hallwich, 1976. It's going to cost you like $115 on Amazon because it's out of print. Or you can pirate a digital copy, whatever you prefer. That one's great. The study on sun exposure is the Melanoma in Southern Sweden study. And the study on melanoma is Melanoma Survival, Marianne Berwick. If you put that in, it'll come up. It's 2005 or 2007. I can't remember exactly which. So Fritz Hallwich was amazing. He was this ophthalmologist in Germany who, with his colleagues in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, they started to do these really interesting procedures and studies that would never pass IRB now. Right. They would do things like they would sew the eyelids of frogs shut and then look at how it changed their physiology. Or they would blind an animal and then see how it changed their like their urinary hormone panel. And they were operating in the early days of cataract surgery, and they didn't have intraocular lenses. So for those of you who don't know, when we do a cataract surgery now, we're cutting the cataract, which is basically like a scar off the front of the eye. And then we're implanting an artificial intraocular lens to take the place of that cataract, because the retina is not supposed to get 100% of the light in the environment. It's got to filter some out. So the intraocular lenses are supposed to do that. But they didn't have that technology when they started doing cataract surgery. They just cut the thing off and then sent the patients on their way. They did before and after urinary hormone levels in patients who'd undergone cataract surgery. And they found that after surgery, they had higher levels of hormones and neurotransmitters in their urine, which implies that their brain was receiving the signal of the light from the environment, and it increased their production of these hormones and neurotransmitters. And this, to me, makes sense from an adaptive or evolutionary framework, right? Because imagine you're living in a ice age in Northern Europe, and your priority should not be to get up and go outside and run around and expend a lot of energy. It should be to rest and to sleep and to be calm and cool and collected and to just chill out, pun intended, until things thaw and there's more food available in the environment. Now, that doesn't mean that you didn't have to go out and occasionally kill the caribou or the woolly mammoth or whatever, but it makes sense. And that's part of why I look at my Oura Ring data, and there's a very clear circannual rhythm in my sleep, where I get about a half an hour to an hour more sleep in the winter than I do in the summer, because I use almost 100% natural light in my day. And so I naturally tend to wind down and get more sleep in the winter, and I have more time awake in the summer. My patients in high latitudes have reported the same thing, and they'll actually kind of call me worried in fairly like Idaho in June. And they're like, "Dr. Stillman, my sleep score is only 65 and I'm worried." And I'm like, "It's okay. You got to make a decision. Are you going to have a circannual rhythm or not?" And sometimes the answers don't sort of cheat a little bit and sleep in and go to sleep earlier, but it all comes down to goals. But anyway, Hallwich's work showed that we produce hormones and neurotransmitters in response to light, because light is a surrogate for the amount of resources in the environment. And when you look at what hormones really do, they turn on and off metabolic processes, and they basically are the governors or regulators of metabolism. So wouldn't it make sense that you would wind all of them down in a season of low caloric load in the environment, if you will, right? And that's how polar bears and seasonally breeding mammals operate, right? The sun goes away and they hibernate. And that's where some of the most interesting literature on this comes from, is actually bears and hibernating physiology. And there's tie-ins with melatonin and all the other hormones and neurotransmitters. And it's fascinating. And it gives you all these tools to help people, because all of a sudden you just change the light environment of their office and they have more energy. I've had women tell me that their hot flashes went away, their menopausal symptoms got better. I've had people tell me all of a sudden they didn't need their afternoon nap. Their sleep gets better. All of a sudden, they're no longer having insomnia or frequent awakenings in the middle of the night. They may just start losing weight out of nowhere. And so it all goes back to this basic physiology of how the brain perceives light through the eye and how that governs all of your metabolism, which is why people don't realize it, but indoor lighting environments are just such a disaster for our physiology. Like, I'll show you, I do this sometimes with patients. So I have a light meter on my phone. It just measures visible light hitting the camera, right? So right now in the office I'm working in, there's 1300 lux of light in the shade facing the back where there's no sunlight. Mm-hmm. And if I turn that towards the window, it's 9,000. And if I put it in the sun, it's about 170,000 lux. your pupil dilates and constricts, so you don't even notice that. You just think, oh, everything is well lit. Well, the average indoor office environment is 5 to 10 lux. That's it. Even a cloudy day in Minnesota in January, I used to work in Minnesota. That's why I use that example. Even a cloudy day in Minnesota, you're looking at hundreds or thousands of lux of light on a cloudy day. And people are living in these offices where they get 2, 3, 4, 5 lux.
So we've created... I feel terrible all the time.
Exactly. But buy a sad light.
That's so funny. I live in Houston and the weather this week was just awful. It was raining almost all week. It felt like Seattle and everything was like, oh, this is terrible. I just could not wait for the sun to come out so I can start going walking again.
Yeah.
And I've just been craving it. One last question on light. So do you daily get like full body sun exposure, like go outside and like shirt off, get 15 or 20 minutes weather permitting?
Generally speaking, yes.
Okay. Because I see you do your social media shirtless half the time.
What's really funny is I decided to stop. I decided it was not professional enough.
Oh, gosh. You know what? I think maybe it is the most professional thing to do is to show people that you're doing what you're asking other folks to do. And anyways, I have a lot of respect for you and I appreciate the work that you're doing. Thanks again for listening to the Blueprint Podcast. And if you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to leave a rating and review on whichever listening platform you are joining us from. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you on the next episode.